at the torn, empty web, and the lump would come to his throat. No one had ever had such a friend, so affectionate, so loyal, and so skillful. The autumn days grew shorter. Lurvy brought the squashes and pumpkins in from the garden and piled them on the barn floor, where they wouldn't get nipped on frosty nights. The maples and birches turned bright colors, and the wind shook them, and they dropped their leaves one by one to the ground. Under the wild apple trees in the pasture, the red little apples lay thick on the ground, and the sheep gnawed them, and the geese gnawed them, and foxes came in the night and sniffed them. One evening, just before Christmas, snow began falling. It covered house and barn and fields and woods. Wilbur had never seen snow before. When morning came, he went out and plowed the drifts in his yard for the fun of it. Fern and Avery arrived, dragging a sled. They coasted down the lane and out onto the frozen pond in the pasture. "Coasting is the most fun there is," said Avery. "The most fun there is," retorted Fern, "is when the Ferris wheel stops and Henry and I are in the top car and Henry makes the car swing and we can see everything for miles and miles and miles." "Goodness, are you still thinking about that old Ferris wheel?" said Avery in disgust. "The fair was weeks and weeks ago." "I think about it all the time," said Fern, picking snow from her ear. After Christmas, the thermometer dropped to 10 below zero. Cold settled on the world. The pasture was bleak and frozen. The cows stayed in the barn all the time now, except on sunny mornings when they went out and stood in the barnyard in the lee of the straw pile. The sheep stayed near the barn, too, for protection. When they were thirsty, they ate snow. The geese hung around the barnyard the way boys hang around a drugstore, and Mr. Zuckerman fed them corn and turnips to keep them cheerful. "Many, many, many thanks," they always said when they saw food coming. Templeton moved indoors when winter came. His ratty home under the pig trough was too chilly, so he fixed himself a cozy nest in the barn behind the grain bins. He lined it with bits of dirty newspapers and rags, and whenever he found a trinket or a keepsake, he carried it home and stored it there. He continued to visit Wilbur 3 times a day, exactly at mealtime, and Wilbur kept the promise he had made. Wilbur let the rat eat first. Then, when Templeton couldn't hold another mouthful, Wilbur would eat. As a result of overeating, Templeton grew bigger and fatter than any rat you ever saw. He was gigantic. He was as big as a young woodchuck. The old sheep spoke to him about his size one day. "You would live longer," said the old sheep, "if you ate less." "Who wants to live forever?" sneered the rat. "I am naturally a heavy eater. I get untold satisfaction from the pleasures of the feast." He patted his stomach, grinned at the sheep, and crept upstairs to lie down. All winter, Wilbur watched over Charlotte's egg sack as though he were guarding his own children. He had scooped out a special place in the manure for the sack next to the board fence. On very cold nights, he lay so that his breath would warm it. For Wilbur, nothing in life was so important as this small round object. Nothing else mattered. Patiently, he awaited the end of winter and the coming of the little spiders. Life is always a rich and steady time when you are waiting for something to happen or to hatch. The winter ended at last. "I heard the frogs today," said the old sheep one evening. "Listen, you can hear them now." Wilbur stood still and cocked his ears. From the pond in shrill chorus came the voices of hundreds of little frogs. "Springtime," said the old sheep thoughtfully. "Another spring." As she walked away, Wilbur saw a new lamb following her. It was only a few hours old. The snows melted and ran away. The streams and ditches bubbled and chattered with rushing water. A sparrow with a streaky breast arrived and sang. The light strengthened. The mornings came sooner. Almost every morning there was another new lamb in the sheepfold. The goose was sitting on 9 eggs. The sky seemed wider, and a warm wind blew. The last remaining strands of Charlotte's old web floated away and vanished. One fine sunny morning after breakfast, Wilbur stood watching his precious sack. He wasn't thinking of anything much. As he stood there, he noticed something move. He stepped closer and stared. A tiny spider crawled from the sack. It was no bigger than a grain of sand, no bigger than the head of a pin. Its body was gray, with a black stripe underneath. Its legs were gray and tan. It looked just like Charlotte. Wilbur trembled all over when he saw it. The little spider waved at him. Then Wilbur looked more closely. Two more little spiders crawled out and waved. They climbed round and round on the sack, exploring their new world. Then three more little spiders, then eight, then 10. Charlotte's children were here at last. Wilbur's heart pounded. He began to squeal. Then he raced in circles, kicking manure into the air. Then he turned a back flip. Then he planted his front feet and came to a stop in front of Charlotte's children. "Hello there," he said. The first spider said hello, but its voice was so small Wilbur couldn't hear it. "I am an old friend of your mother's," said Wilbur. "I am glad to see you. Are you all right? Is everything all right?" The little spiders waved their four legs at him. Wilbur could see by the way they acted that they were glad to see him. "Is there anything I can get you? Is there anything you need?" The young spiders just waved. For several days and several nights they crawled here and there, up and down, around and about, waving at Wilbur, trailing tiny drag lines behind them and exploring their home. There were dozens and dozens of them. Wilbur couldn't count them, but he knew that he had a great many new friends. They grew quite rapidly. Soon each was as big as a BB shot. They made tiny webs near the sack. Then came a quiet morning when Mr. Zuckerman opened a door on the north side. A warm draft of rising air blew softly through the barn cellar. The air smelled of the damp earth, of the spruce woods, of the sweet springtime. The baby spiders felt the warm updraft. One spider climbed to the top of the fence. Then it did something that came as a great surprise to Wilbur. The spider stood on its head, pointed its spinnerets in the air, and let loose a cloud of fine silk. The silk formed a balloon. As Wilbur watched, the spider let go of the fence and rose into the air. "Goodbye," it said, as it sailed through the doorway. "Wait a minute," screamed Wilbur. "Where do you think you're going?" But the spider was already out of sight. Then another baby spider crawled to the top of the fence, stood on its head, made a balloon, and sailed away. Then another spider, then another. The air was soon filled with tiny balloons, each balloon carrying a spider. Wilbur was frantic. Charlotte's babies were disappearing at a great rate. "Come back, children," he cried. "Goodbye," they called. "Goodbye, goodbye." At last, one little spider took time enough to stop and talk to Wilbur before making its balloon. "We're leaving here on the warm updraft. This is our moment for setting forth. We are aeronauts, and we are going out into the world to make webs for ourselves." "But where?" asked Wilbur. "Wherever the wind takes us, high, low, near, far, east, west, north, south, we take to the breeze. We go as we please." "Are all of you going?" asked Wilbur. "You can't all go. I would be left alone with no friends. Your mother wouldn't want that to happen, I'm sure." The air was now so full of balloonists that the barn cellar looked almost as though a mist had gathered. Balloons by the dozen were rising, circling, and drifting away through the door, sailing off on the gentle wind. Cries of "goodbye, goodbye, goodbye" came weakly to Wilbur's ears. He couldn't bear to watch any more. In sorrow, he sank to the ground and closed his eyes. This seemed like the end of the world, to be deserted by Charlotte's children. Wilbur cried himself to sleep. When he woke, it was late afternoon. He looked at the egg sack. It was empty. He looked into the air. The balloonists were gone. Then he walked drearily to the doorway where Charlotte's web used to be. He was standing there thinking of her when he heard a small voice. "Salutations," it said. "I'm up here." "So am I," said another tiny voice. "So am I," said a third voice. "Three of us are staying. We like this place and we like you." Wilbur looked up. At the top of the doorway, three small webs were being constructed. On each web, working busily, was one of Charlotte's daughters. "Can I take this to mean," asked Wilbur, "that you have definitely decided to live here in the barn cellar and that I am going to have three friends?" "You can indeed," said the spiders. "What are your names, please?" asked Wilbur. trembling with joy. "I'll tell you my name," replied the fresh little spider, "if you'll tell me why you are trembling." "I'm trembling with joy," said Wilbur. "Then my name is Joy," said the first spider. "What was my mother's middle initial?" asked the second spider. "A," said Wilbur. "Then my name is Urania," said the spider. "How about me?" asked the third spider. "Will you just pick out a nice, sensible name for me, something not too long, not too fancy, and not too dumb?" Wilbur thought hard. "Nelly," he suggested. "Fine, I like that very much," said the third spider. "You may call me Nelly." She daintily fastened her orb line to the next spoke of the web. Wilbur's heart brimmed with happiness. He felt that he should make a short speech on this very important occasion. "Joy, Urania, Nelly," he began, "welcome to the barn cellar. You have chosen a hallowed doorway from which to string your webs. I think it is only fair to tell you that I was devoted to your mother. I owe my very life to her. She was brilliant, beautiful, and loyal to the end. I shall always treasure her memory. To you, her daughters, I pledge my friendship forever and ever." "I pledge mine," said Joy. "I do too," said Urania. "And so do I," said Nelly, who had just managed to catch a small gnat. It was a happy day for Wilbur, and many more happy, tranquil days followed. As time went on, and the months and years came and went, he was never without friends. Fern did not come regularly to the barn anymore. She was growing up and was careful to avoid childish things, like sitting on a milk stool near a pig pen. But Charlotte's children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, year after year, lived in the doorway. Each spring, there were new little spiders hatching out to take the place of the old. Most of them sailed away on their balloons, but always two or three stayed and set up housekeeping in the doorway. Mr. Zuckerman took fine care of Wilbur all the rest of his days, and the pig was often visited by friends and admirers, for nobody ever forgot the year of his triumph and the miracle of the web. Life in the barn was very good. Night and day, winter and summer, spring and fall, dull days and bright days. It was the best place to be, thought Wilbur, this warm, delicious cellar, with the garrulous geese, the changing seasons, the heat of the sun, the passage of swallows, the nearness of rats, the sameness of sheep, the love of spiders, the smell of manure, and the glory of everything. Wilbur never forgot Charlotte. Although he loved her children and grandchildren dearly, none of the new spiders ever quite took her place in his heart. She was in a class by herself. It is not often that someone comes along who is a true friend and a good writer. Charlotte was both.
Hello, this is George Plimpton. I'm going to read a special afterword created for the 50th anniversary retrospective edition of Charlotte's Web. Suppose you were allowed only 5 words to try to save the life of your friend. What would they be? That's the sort of problem E.B. White faced when composing his second and most celebrated children's book, Charlotte's Web, in 1952. In the 50 years since they appeared, Wilbur the Pig, Charlotte the Spider, Templeton the Scavenging Rat, and the miraculous web that weaves them all together have continued to win the hearts of boys and girls and even adults. Because children had welcomed White's mouse boy Stuart Little 7 years earlier, White's publisher, Harper & Brothers, ran a first printing of 50,000 copies of Charlotte's Web. Today, more than 8 million copies of the book have been sold, and it has been translated into almost 20 languages, including Welsh, Polish, and 3 different languages of India, Bengali, Marathi, and Telugu. Elwin Brooks White, known as N as a boy, was born in Mount Vernon, New York, in 1899, the youngest of 6 children. As a boy, White suffered terrible hay fever, so in 1905, his father began taking the family for summer vacations to the Belgravia Lakes in Maine. These summers forever etched a deep love for nature in White that went on to inspire all his children's books. He played the piano, rode a bicycle, captained a first-rate old-town canoe, kept pigeons, snakes, pollywogs, turtles, rabbits, lizards, singing birds, chameleons, caterpillars, and mice, and swung on a rope swing just as Fern does. White's older brother, Stanley, was a kind teacher to him. He instructed White in physics, music, canoe paddling, and jackknife manipulation. An interest in words was also encouraged in the White household. Stanley helped teach White to read by having him sound out syllables from the New York Times. The boy's father, Samuel Tilly White, would send them to look up words in the Webster's Unabridged Dictionary in Big Brother Albert's room, where the irresistible typewriter also stood. Years later, White said that his father didn't hesitate to say in 20 words what could be said in 6. Like Charlotte, and like his father, White loved to experiment with words. At the age of 9, he won his first literary prize for a poem about a mouse. Not long afterward came 2 more writing awards from St. Nicholas Magazine. When it was time to go to college, White decided to enroll at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. He landed a position his freshman year on the school newspaper. By his junior year, he was editor-in-chief. At Cornell, White was given the nickname Andy, after the university's first president, Andrew D. White. In his opinion, that was a great improvement over Elwin, and his friends called him Andy from then on. A big change in White's life came in 1925. On February 19th of that year, the New Yorker magazine appeared on newsstands for the first time. The magazine seemed to speak directly to White, and he recognized that this was the sort of writing he was able to do well. He submitted some work, and by its 9th week, the magazine included a short piece by White. Harold Ross, the editor, was thoroughly impressed with the young writer. By 1926, Ross had convinced White to begin working part-time for the New Yorker, editing and writing captions and some original pieces. White also worked closely with another editor there, Catherine Sargent Angel, and in 1929, she and White were married. Throughout the years, the two worked both independently and as a team. Catherine was a skilled fiction editor at the New Yorker and wrote book reviews and garden columns on her own. Catherine had 2 children from a previous marriage, Roger and Nancy. Then in 1930, Catherine and White's own son, Joel, was born. Although White and his family were living in New York, he often thought back happily to the old family excursions to Maine. It wasn't long before he and Catherine began to head north for vacations. One day, when they were sailing off Allen Cove, they passed a house and saltwater farm that beckoned them. 5 years later, it was theirs, and in 1938, they moved to Maine, though keeping their work and associations in New York. Catherine began writing reviews of children's books, and packages of books were soon flooding the house. White wrote, "Close physical contact with the field of juvenile literature leads me to the conclusion that it must be a lot of fun to write for children. Reasonably easy work, perhaps even important work." Easy work was surely said in jest, for White had actually been working on a story for children for many years. In the 1920s, White had a vivid dream about a mouse child. Since he had 18 nieces and nephews to whom he told stories, White began to write the tale of a little mouse boy, Stuart Little. White worked at the story on and off. In 1944, he finished it and left the book with an editor, Ursula Nordstrom, in New York, and she accepted it for publication. Ursula Nordstrom had been the head of the children's books department at Harper & Brothers since 1940. She earned an honored place in the history of American children's books for nurturing such talents as Ruth Krauss, Marie Sendak, Laura Ingalls Wilder, Tommy Ungerer, and Shel Silverstein. She had a sense of what each author or artist needed in the way of help, sympathy, or even prodding. For White, she was able to answer his questions, such as whether there had been any other books about a spider spinning words, to discuss royalty arrangements, or just simply to keep in touch and offer kind words when he sent her reports of ill health. She also helped